But first, Josepha Madigan, Junior Minister with Special Responsibility for Special Education and Inclusion, and also TD for Dublin Rathdown, is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Now, in July, you said that significant progress had been made around the creation of more school places in Dublin for children with special needs in September, which is just coming up in a week. There were 106 places, I think, needed at that time. What's the update there today?
Yeah, so I think, Claire, if we look back to even May, when I had been speaking around the area of special education, and we had, I think, approximately 50 children who needed a special school place in Dublin, and we had about 80 children who needed a special class place. We have now managed, through very intensive engagement with the National Council for Special Education, indeed the department, and with the assistance of schools, to create an additional 314 special class places. So I'm very pleased that this September we will have sufficient capacity throughout Dublin, not just in Dublin, but throughout Dublin and around the country, to make sure that we can accommodate all children in special schools and special classes. That's primarily because of St Michael's House, who's a patron on the north side of Dublin. They've agreed to open a second site on their site in Swords, where they will accommodate an extra 24 children. And also in Tempelogue, the Spiritans are also going to accommodate 24 children going to special schools. It's really important, together with the special education legislation, which we brought in, as you mentioned, in July. It came into being on the 19th of July. And that will make a demonstrable effort in terms of trying to secure places for children with additional needs. The difficulty that we had all along is that whilst the majority of special classes are created outside of the Section 37A process, it just wasn't happening quick enough. And there were still children falling through the cracks. There were children that weren't known to the NCSE, who were looking for places during the year, and it just simply wasn't good enough. So now we have capacity for this year for all children.
So people will remember perhaps that you fast-tracked the Section 37A, and that means that schools can be directed at a much pacier rate to make additional provision. How many times have those powers been used?
So this is the third time that the Section 37A has been triggered. It's now a truncated process. So a school can be forced, if you like, or compelled to open a special class place once we receive a detailed report from the NCSE within 6 to 8 weeks. And that's significantly different from what it was before. It was taking up to 18 months on occasion. That Section 37 I had under review anyway, together with the Epson Act, which is the main legislation which underpins all of special education. That is being reviewed also. It's to a certain extent obsolete. It's there for 17 years. We need to amend that. We need to review it. We need to make sure that it's up to date. But my intention always was that the No Child wouldn't have a child without additional needs wouldn't have a place in a special school, in a special class, or indeed in mainstream.
It caused great upset, though, didn't it, in the schools when you named and shamed some schools who you said were not cooperating?
Yeah, and I think that's the difficulty with the Section 37A process. Anyway, by its very nature, the information is publicised. It's put up on the departmental website. Nobody wants to name and shame schools. But now schools will have no option. So if the NCSE approach them and ask them to open a special class and they don't, then we will trigger the Section 37A process. I have to say as well that since we triggered the Section 37A process, 9 special classes out of those 14 schools have been opened, and that has made a major difference. We'll have 2,535 special classes opened by the end of this year. That's an increase of almost 500% since 2011. But one of the things that I'm looking at, Claire, in terms of forecasting for the future, is around the prevalence rate. We have been looking at a sort of 1.5% to 1.55% rate. Now, it's not a national statistic, but looking at some of the international evidence, we can see that it's about 3.8%. And I will certainly be talking about that in budget negotiations.
So we have a higher need.
We have a higher need. We all know that autism is growing in particular exponentially, not just in Ireland, but throughout the world, and other complex needs. And we need to cater for that.
And do you know why that's the case, that we have a higher rate of prevalence in this country?
We don't know the reason, but it's certainly indicative of from my conversations with and my own personal experience from speaking with principals and teachers and indeed parents and indeed the National Council for Special Education. I imagine the Department of Health do a bit of research around that and throughout the world. And I know the NCSE does its own research and communicates with other international bodies and agencies
around
that.
That's significant. If the international is 3.8%, we're at 5.5%. Do you suspect there's misdiagnosis going on? Or
1.5% is what the 2018 NCSE report said, and the HSE reported a similar one saying 1.55%, but we believe it's about 3.8%.
Okay.
And in fact, there was a very senior therapist in the COPE Foundation who would be of the view that it's around 3.8%. And that's a big difference when you're planning for infrastructure for schools in terms of accommodating, in terms of reconfiguring classrooms and providing the facilities that these children so badly need.
Mm-hmm. And I know it was a criticism from the Ombudsman, wasn't it, for children, that planning was not happening in advance so that we wouldn't face this situation every year where there's a shortage of places. But what do you suspect is going on with those numbers?
First of all, I don't dispute the Ombudsman's figures, and I think that we now have a forward planning system in place where a geographical information system from the planning and building unit in the department is shared directly with the National Council for Special Education so that we can see in real time where capacity is needed. I'm not a medic. I'm not sure myself why it is growing exponentially, but it is, and it's something that we're very mindful of and cognizant of. And also the assessment to need process, which is under Minister Anne Rabbitt's remit, and she is doing her best to try to reduce that waiting list. And as that happens, there are more children being diagnosed, and you need a diagnosis for a special class or a special school, not for mainstream. And it's important to stress the majority of children, in fact 98% of children, attend mainstream schools.
Okay.
So we're talking about a minority, and an important minority.
You mentioned as part of the solution this year the places you have in Swords in Dublin and in Temple Oak in Dublin, but there has been criticism of the fact that children are not going to school in their own local areas. So in order to solve the problem this year, will children have to travel?
Yeah, I mean, again, this was something that the Ombudsman for Children pointed out in his report. We're spending, as a state, about 289 million a year to transport about 121,000 children. 15,500 of those are children with additional needs. To me, that shouldn't be happening. But in the first instance, and I know that this has been acknowledged by the Ombudsman and other advocacy groups, we need to find an appropriate placement for the child in the first instance. After that, we try to find a placement in the locality. It is a right under the Constitution to have an education for a child with additional needs, not necessarily in their own locality, but obviously that's what we all want. But in the first instance, this was an emergency where we wanted to find appropriate placements for these children, first of all. And I also want to thank the Cork ETB as well, who did a lot of work in terms of Rochestown Special School as well. The Spirit and Education Trust are the very first fee-charging patron to assist us in terms of helping children with additional needs. And I would like to see that memorandum of understanding expanded to other fee-charging schools throughout the country. There's no reason why it should be just the purview of public-funded schools. And I think that's something, that's a cultural ethos that needs to change. There are plenty of fee-charging schools in Dublin in particular and in other counties around the country that could provide an education to these children.
You suggested earlier in the year on Twitter, and I know that you were subject to a lot of criticism for this, a plan to segregate children with autism and other disabilities in special education centres. Now, this plan, does that follow through on that suggestion?
Well, first of all, the reason I put it on Twitter is that it already was in the public domain. It had been published in the Irish Times. It had only ever been a proposal that had germinated through the department and the National Council for Special Education, who, in fairness to them, were trying to come up with an alternative to home tuition, where many, many parents, including the National Parents Council, have said to me that they wanted an alternative to home tuition. And this was in the context where we didn't have places for them. We knew that we wouldn't have places for children come September. That is now not an issue because we do have places for children in September. But, you know, I would always be of the view that children should be included and integrated into schools insofar as we can. Home tuition is an interim measure that is there for children for many different reasons, some who maybe suffer from mental health or maybe going through cancer treatment,
yeah, but
other issues like that.
But for the segregation, children, I suppose at the time people wanted to know, was this what you believed about where these children should be?
Absolutely not. And I certainly never said that. The reason why I tweeted it is because it was in the Irish Times and I wanted people to know what exactly the proposal was. But I think that, you know, the Special Education Consultative Forum, which I set up myself and the advocacy group sit on that, they know that no proposal would actually become policy without their approval. And that was, you know, was always going to be the case and will always be the case when we're talking about alternatives to home tuition into the future.
Mm, but I suppose people who were facing this situation were wondering, what is your theory on where these children should be? Because what you suggested, and I know Adam Harris from As I Am said this among others, that it flies in the face of our obligations and our commitments under the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities.
Yeah, and I totally appreciate that. And Adam knows, he sits on the Special Education Consultative Forum, that no proposal would have gone through without their approval. And that remains the case. And we take a consultative approach in relation to all measures that we try to bring.
Okay. On energy fears, again, this is on the front of the Irish Times today, where it says worst case scenario to see majority in energy poverty. Is there a plan in place for schools coming into the autumn and the winter? So they're used to being cold in the classroom because of COVID, but will they be forced to turn down the heating?
I don't think so. I would hope not. I know that there are specific contracts that the department procures with energy providers in terms of providing heating in schools. Now, I know that we have always said, and the government has always said, that obviously you want to encourage not just homeowners, but commercial users and big energy users to not use energy at peak times and to try and, you know, I suppose, save on energy when you can. But that's not to say that we want children to go cold. That certainly isn't going to happen.
OK, and how concerned at government, how much concern is there at government level about what might happen with energy security in the winter?
Well, I think it is a concern. I know that there were options and contracts that were put there in place for energy companies and they fell through. And I think that that is a pity. But I know that there is a lot of work that's been done in terms of additional generation over this winter. And there are plans to address that, particularly for next year. But, you know, I don't think we should raise expectations and say in any way that it's not going to be a difficult winter. I think it will be a difficult winter.
Because the Irish Times reports today on the energy supply group briefing, and these were figures prepared by the ESRI, and in there it says should there be a fuel shortage or an energy shortage, an energy crisis, fuel allocation would be to emergency and critical services only. Does that include schools?
I would assume that it would. I mean, you know, even from last year, even during COVID, we have always maintained and advocated that schools are and education is a priority and has always been a priority for this government. So there's no reason why schools won't remain, you know, have their heating. And we, you know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is move towards renewable energies, which we will need in order to provide all of this energy into the future. Mm-hmm. It's just not sustainable otherwise.
And on school transport, we know that there are many, many parents around the country who are waiting to hear if their child got a place. And there were a record number of applicants because the fees have been removed as a cost of living measure for this year. And of course, there will be people who are in your department or who are taken care of in your department who will have to travel to school. Do you know and have you heard how many people will be left disappointed or how that problem will be addressed?
Well, my understanding is that anybody who's applied for a transport ticket will be given a transport ticket.
How though? Because we know there's a shortage of drivers, there's a shortage of buses.
Well, no, I do understand that there had been a delay in terms of the processing of those tickets, and I believe and I understand that that has now been rectified. The transport is free for children. As I mentioned earlier, there's over 121,000 children who are transported by the state. There used to be a €500 charge. That will now be a saving for families. And you know, there's no child that shouldn't be in a position to avail of that if they need it.
I was reading today, though, parents who had always paid for that ticket, they applied again this year and they have no transport, and somebody who is living in Offaly going to work in Dublin and having to drive their children to school now, it's completely disruptive.
Yeah, that is completely disruptive. But my understanding is that there shouldn't be a difficulty with any child.
So no child will be left without a place on the bus?
No, and I know that there are grants available for if there is some difficulty in terms of getting transport, there are grants available to get substituted transport from other providers. So there should be no reason. So what I would suggest they do, if there's any individual circumstance, that they contact the Department of Education and discuss that.
All right, let's move on to your government colleague, Robert Troy, who people will know apologised yesterday for this series of errors, as he described it, relating to properties and his register of interests. Company directorship also not declared on his register of interests. He also failed to register a tenancy with the RTB. And for all of those things, he said that he didn't know the rules or he misunderstood the rules. Now, you as a solicitor, you know that ignorance of the law is no excuse. And yet everyone is accepting, it seems, at government level, that this is an excuse.
Well, I think, first of all, Robert has apologised for his misdemeanours, for want of a better word. He's held his hand up. He said, he didn't, put down the right information. He misinterpreted what he was supposed to do. And I think from my own perspective, the fact that he has apologised is a start, but I do very much welcome the fact that he will give a dual statement and that he will take questions on that.
What more can he say? I mean, if that's just a start, what more needs to happen?
Well, I think any further actions that are warranted are under the purview of the standards in public office.
There's nothing they can do, it seems.
Well, there are sanctions there, actually. I think if there's a complaint and there's an investigation, there are summary convictions and there are convictions on indictment. So that's a matter for the standard. They're public knowledge. They're just the sanctions.
So you see this as a very serious matter.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there are sanctions through SIPO. I think some people have been saying that SIPO is toothless in its agency, but actually it does have sanctions. So it's not a matter for me to say. I'm neither Robert Troy's defender nor his executioner. I simply welcome the fact that he's apologised for what he said and the fact that he will give further details to the Dáil in relation to this.
Yeah, it's different. What I'm hearing from you is quite different to what has come from your party leader, Leo Varadkar, who described Robert Troy as top class. You're staying on the fence here.
Robert Troy, no, I'm not. Robert Troy works with the Tánaiste. The Tánaiste has full confidence in Robert Troy. I have full confidence in Robert Troy. I welcome the fact that he's going to be giving a full explanation and that he's open to meeting with SIPO, that he's open to meeting with the RTB, that he's open to taking questions from the opposition in the Dáil, which is only a matter of weeks away.
Do you accept his explanation that he looked at the SIPO rules and he thought, well, I only have to declare what I owned at the end of any given year? Because I've read the rules and it's really easy to understand that you declare what you had and what you were doing.
Just recently myself, I'm not a landlord myself. He has a number of different properties and he obviously, that's what he felt was the right at the time, and he made a mistake. And I think that, people make mistakes, but he has apologised for that and he's acknowledged that. And he said he's embarrassed about it. I think.
But going back to your own profession, right? If you brought this line of defence into a courtroom, hypothetically speaking, would it hold water for a regular member of the public to say, I didn't really understand the law?
Well, look, that's a matter for SIPO. It's a SIPO form. I'm not SIPO. I accept his apology. I accept the bona fides of what he's saying, that he didn't intend to mislead anybody. My dealings with Robert Troy has always been very honourable person to deal with on every level. But he will answer questions in the Dáil, and that's a matter for him and others.
Fintan O'Toole wrote about this yesterday and he brought great clarity to the whole thing. I thought he said he didn't bother to follow the rules that are simple to understand and easy to comply with. It makes a mockery of public ethics.
Again, it's a matter for the Standards in Public Office Commission to look at this. He's taken full responsibility. He's willing to take questions in the Dáil. And I think any further actions, if they're warranted, will be a matter for SIPO.
The other matter, of course, coming down the tracks is this reshuffle we expect when Leo Varadkar takes over and returns to the office of Taoiseach. Do you think that Minister Robert Troy should be vetoed from taking up another role in Cabinet in the second term of the Coalition?
I think that's a matter for his boss, who is the current Taoiseach.
Would you be happy to serve with him in cabinet after all this?
That's a hypothetical, because we don't even know yet what if there's going to be any further developments in this. I've accepted his apology. As I said, I've accepted his bona fides. I think he did make a genuine mistake. I understand the optics of it. I understand the public's perception of it.
You'd have no problem serving with Robert Troy in cabinet after Christmas.
If Minister Troy is reappointed, then and I am reappointed for that matter, then I will serve with him. And again, it's up to the Standards and Public Commission. I'm not, as I said, as defender or as executioner.
Minister Josepha Madigan, thank you very much for coming in. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.